Okay. This is it. I'm going to try to keep it together. We'll wrap up all of our topics in power electronics for the semester today. Before we do announcements, please do fill out the new course evaluation. We haven't quite made it there. We've got 78%, have filled it out in 481, 67, and 599. Big bump in 599. Only one more in 481. We have a few more people to fill this out if we want to get this extra credit on the final. Reminder, that's not individually. That's if both of these get to 100, everybody gets 5%. Questions on that? Like I said in the past, I do value student feedback on these. Adjust the course accordingly year to year. So please do fill that out and let me know your thoughts.
Can you probably send an email for those people who may not come to class?
Sure. I will send out an email after class anyway today with a password for homework, accessing the final. Put a comment in there about this. Arguable whether people, if they don't come to class, are going to read my emails, so maybe some peer-to-peer influence might help. Okay. Any other questions? I don't know.
Yeah.
Don't want to know. Completely anonymous. I have no idea. Okay. So we have a little bit of material that I'm going to cover just on wrapping up some of this magnetics design. So we've been talking in the last few classes about first magnetics modeling and then design of magnetic components. We did first this KG method, which considered only DC copper loss for our loss mechanism, and balanced that with the requirement that the inductor doesn't saturate. The assumption is this is a small ripple inductor. We want to push it kind of close to saturation to get the lowest losses, but make sure it doesn't saturate. Then we went and looked at some of these more complex loss mechanisms, AC copper losses. Briefly at the end of last class, talked about things like skin effect, which causes current to crowd around the outer surface of a conductor, effectively lowers the area through which the current is conducted and thereby increases the resistance. Proximity losses, when we have multiple layers of winding, the flux kind of multiplies up layer to layer and it causes a rapid increase in losses as we go through additional layers. Fringing flux, I'll show a little bit today, has a similar kind of effect as proximity losses. It's from flux penetrating adjacent conductors, causes additional losses. And then in core loss, we talked a little bit about the different mechanisms, high-level view of the physics behind it, but in the end, use the Steinmetz equation to model core loss, which is a purely empirical equation. It's just a curve fit to measured losses. Reminder that Steinmetz equation looks like this. It says that the volumetric power losses, so power loss in watts per unit volume of the core, look like some constant times frequency to an exponent times delta B to an exponent. And these exponentials look linear when I plot them on a log-log scale. It implies that core losses increase very rapidly with both frequency and delta B. Linear on a log-log scale, which means it's increasing pretty quick. If it was on a linear scale, they'd be exponential. So we're going to do two things. One is look at a different design method that takes into account core loss using the Steinmetz equation and still just DC copper loss, incorporating AC loss mechanisms, particularly this proximity effect, has a lot to do with the physical arrangement of the windings, which makes it hard to have one of these closed form design methods. It says, just do this many turns. the losses really depend on exactly where you put those turns within the window area. So when you get into kind of fine-grained modeling of these AC loss mechanisms, generally one of these nice closed form design methods doesn't exist. More iteration and simulation. So we're going to talk about that. Before we get there, I'm going to give just a simulation example to show some of these AC winding loss mechanisms. So throughout, this is going to be what I'm simulating. It is a transformer. Where out here is the core. And here in the window, I have two windings, three layers of primary, these green ones, and then three layers of secondary. And this is just a cross-sectional view cut through the core, whole thing in 3D. These windings would come around, wrap around this core, and have a total of six layers all wrapped up. Okay. Using 30-gauge copper wire, skin depth is equal to the diameter of the wire at around 50 kilohertz. I'm going to put 1 amp in both the primary and secondary. It'll be the same number of turns on both, so it's a one-to-one transformer. Okay. All these simulations are done in a free tool called FEM, which is available at this page. It's got a plug-in to MATLAB where you can use MATLAB to generate and run all the simulations in this finite element tool. Okay. So I'm going to look at two things, the flux density and where there is flux on the scale on the left, and the current density scale on the right. Both of them are going to be blue is not a lot, pink is a lot, yellow is intermediate. And I'll keep flux over here on the left, current density on the right. So I go through, here's my first simulation. I put currents at 1 kilohertz. This is simulating purely sinusoidal currents. But I have 1 amp at 1 kilohertz in the primary, 1 amp at 1 kilohertz in the secondary. First on my current density plot, all of the windings just look uniform in terms of color, which means at this low frequency, the current just flows uniformly through each wire, evenly distributed across the whole area. The flux, you start to see what we looked at with the proximity effect that I have between the first two windings, C, and here, 2 feet, my flux kind of amplifies up with each adjacent layer of primary and then goes back down when I start hitting the secondaries. Here, because again, my frequency is much lower than the frequency required to get significant skin effect, the flux just flows right through. As I go up in frequency, now at 100 kilohertz, I begin to see, maybe hard to see on this projector, but a little bit of current crowding towards the inside, these innermost layers. Okay? Starting to get a little bit more yellow and maybe a little bit red in here, meaning that there is a higher current density on those innermost layers. The net current through the winding is still 1 amp everywhere. That higher current density indicates there's eddy currents in addition to the 1 amp. Okay. Losses have increased by almost 100%, 80% larger, or 1.8x. If I keep going at 1 megahertz, I start to see very significant skin effect, very significant proximity effect. So now in all of my layers, the current is crowded towards the side, particularly in these innermost layers where proximity effect is going to be the worst. I'm seeing massive current densities on either side, and then almost no current flowing through the middle. Now the flux, you can see, is very high in between the windings, causing these eddy currents on the sides of the windings that are exposed to that flux. My loss is 20 times larger than it was at 1 kilohertz. I keep going at 10 megahertz. This is going to be a terrible design, 65 times the loss, even worse in terms of my current distribution. Okay. So my actual resistance of this winding as 10 megahertz current goes through, it would be 65 times what I would predict if I just considered the DC copper loss. Okay. That being said, we're designing a 10 megahertz magnetic and we're just approximating it with the DC copper loss. So we've made a mistake from the start. Okay. Let's see. Okay. That's what I wanted to show on this simulation, showing some skin effect and proximity effect in the windings. The other thing from our chart was this fringing effect, which is really a similar thing. So proximity effect, we have this flux which hits kind of the left-right side of these windings and causes eddy currents which cancel out that flux. We can have the same thing in a gapped core. So now I have a air gap here. In this case, I'm just simulating an inductor, one winding. And talked about around the gap, the flux. So, you know, out here, the flux stays in the core, was in this path around the gap. Because it's flowing through air, it doesn't have as much incentive to stay within the core boundaries, and we'll get this fringing effect. That'll happen here. I have my gap both on the center leg and the outer leg of this inductor. So I get fringing effect here as well. And that fringing flux is going to come out here, hit these windings, and cause eddy currents in them, which is going to cause additional loss. This one, rather than clicking through, I believe I have an animation where we gradually increase frequency. This is showing the current density in the windings and the flux as these contours. As I go up towards 1.6 megahertz with the exact same net current flowing through this winding, I get extremely high current densities, meaning currents dominated by eddy currents. So I'm going to have very high losses or even the same amount of current flowing through this thing. Okay. You see, can I draw while the animation's running? Maybe. Here, adjacent to the gap, is where I get the first insight into this fringing flux causing additional losses. Even down at 10 kilohertz, I'm starting to see that fringing flux penetrating the windings and causing eddy current losses. So one way to deal with all of these different AC copper losses that have to do with adjacent flux penetration of the winding is to essentially get rid of skin effect. You saw the flux density largely the same even in the low frequency simulations. I still have this higher flux through the center because of my multiple layers of primary. But I don't get significant additional AC losses because at this frequency, diameter of the wire is smaller than the skin depth. So I don't have enough room for those eddy currents to flow. I can't develop and I don't get these additional losses. So if I use smaller conductors, I can go to even higher frequency. The problem would be if I just make this exact same thing at a much smaller conductor, I'm going to have a much higher resistance of that winding because the area of the wire is smaller. If I use just stranded wire, but each of the individual wires is small, and instead of one big wire, I just have a bunch of little ones making up the same area, then I can get the same effective area, same DC resistance. And in the end, I'll get no benefit out of that, though. It's stranded wire, the individual strands aren't isolated, so current can still jump from one to the other, and it'll behave the same as this. In fact, a little bit worse, because I'll have more free space in there, more free air, get a little bit lower fill factor. So stranded wire won't help me, and using solid core wires of very small gauge will help in terms of the skin effect, but will increase my resistance anyway. So it may not be 65 times larger at 1 megahertz, but it'll be 65 times larger at DC and then stay the same up to 1 megahertz. Okay. One way to accommodate this is LITS wire, which is a special type of wire that is stranded wire, but it's created in a special way where every one of the individual strands inside that bundle is isolated. So it has a thin coating that electrically isolates it from adjacent strands. And then it is twisted in a special way where it's not just a big bundle of wires twisted to make it all spirally. Instead, it's kind of braided so that no two strands of wire stay adjacent to each other for an extended period of time. And that prevents eddy currents from developing from two adjacent strands of wire. So in normal, just stranded wire, what I'd have is multiple strands that are not isolated, and they just flow parallel to one another. Means current can jump between them. It really just looks like a bigger conductor with a weird shape, and eddy currents can develop between them. In LITS wire, if I looked at any individual strand, just drawing some pattern here. None of these two strands flow adjacent to one another. They constantly switch, rearrange, so that within some distance known as the pitch, any of these strands rotate through this braiding so that they're no longer next to each other. And that prevents eddy currents from developing from the adjacent conductor. Okay. And then they are, every strand is isolated. So the trade-off here, this can significantly reduce proximity losses, skin effect losses at the expense of increased cost. I want to go very high frequency to make sure that the diameter of an individual wire is smaller than the skin depth. I may need to go with extremely small wires and thousands of them in one bundle to make up the overall wire, bundle of LITS wire, this thing. That can be extremely expensive compared to normal wire. And there's some limit. I start going up in the 100 megahertz range, it's just impossible to manufacture a wire without it constantly breaking that's thin enough to have a diameter less than the skin depth. Yeah. Right, before I get into this, other solutions to things like this, this fringing flux problem, an approach is to move these windings, the ones closest to the gap that are having the worst impact of fringing flux. Take those two and move them out here. Try to wind in a special way where windings are removed from that fringing field. Mentioned before, but on this transformer, best approach would be to interleave. Instead of primary, 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 secondary, 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 primary, secondary, primary, secondary, primary, secondary. That would prevent this kind of multiplication of flux and losses in the center. Questions on any of that? Okay, final topic, cover briefly, is chapter 15, which is this KGFE method that was promised for transformer design, which differs a little bit from the KG method that we used for inductor design. Generally more tailored towards transformers, though it can be used for multi-winding inductors or even single-winding inductors. Okay. So in the discussion last time, is it transformer that we're designing is not an energy storage transformer. It's not a flyback transformer that is the main filter inductor. We're generally going to design with no air gap. And the goal of the transformer is to look as close as possible to an ideal transformer. We want a large magnetizing inductance. We don't want it to store energy. We just want the right turns ratio and low losses. So in contrast to our inductor design method, where we were trying to prevent saturation and achieve a given inductance, here we're really going to do two things. One is obtain turns ratio for a two-winding transformer, N1 to N2, which is whatever we specify from our circuit analysis, whatever I want out of this thing. And then two is to minimize losses. In this case, as promised, we're going to consider core and DC copper losses. So a total loss in this model is going to be DC copper losses plus core losses. And then additionally in there, we're still going to have three, make sure windings fit. So you'll notice removed from the KG method is any consideration of saturation. So that's not going to be inherent in this design method, considering these three metrics, something that would have to be checked afterwards. Going to try to minimize the losses, rarely, but in some cases, that loss minimization is going to happen with very high peak flux density, higher than your saturation limit. The design would predict something that you'd have to assess afterwards and say, oh, this saturated is not actually going to work. Okay. So these total losses that we're considering, the sum of copper and core losses, we'll look briefly at what these look like. So my copper losses at DC look like IRMS squared times the resistance of each winding. It'll be the sum over all windings of IRMS, the winding squared times that winding's resistance. It's going to look like rho Ni MLT over A sub W. This is our expression for the DC resistance, resistivity times length over area. The area of the winding we're going to try to make as big as possible, subject to constraint 3, so that we can minimize these losses. So area of each winding is going to be dictated the same as it was in the KG method, that it is some fill factor times the winding area needs to fit the total area of all windings, like WAKU. Our core window area times some fill factor times this alpha, which scales how much of it is allocated to each winding, divided by the number of turns. What I'm trying to get with all these equations is to show that if I plug this back in, I would get N in the denominator. This whole thing goes in the denominator, I get some N squared. And I, the number of turns for the I winding. I would get that my DC copper losses are proportional to N squared. As I add more and more turns, keeping the same turns ratio between each winding, my conduction losses are going to go up as the square of the number of turns. More turns means smaller area to fit it in there, and longer length. Having both of those happen at the same time gives us a square type relationship. Okay. When I look at core losses, model those with the Steinmetz equation, which looks like Km times switching frequency to the alpha, delta B to the beta, times the effective volume of the core. Delta B can solve from any of the windings as 1 over Ni AC times the integral from 0 to T of Vi dt. If I plug that in here, I'm going to have a dependence of T core. Of 1 over n to the beta. Generally, beta is greater than 1 for any of these core materials. More often, it's greater than 2, but definitely greater than 1. Okay. So why I wrote all this is to motivate that there is some ability to minimize this loss total. So really my main parameter that I can play with is pick a winding, the number of turns on it. Then for all other windings, the number of turns is going to be dictated by my turns ratio. So that's my freedom for a given core. When I look at how the copper losses depend on that selection, well, they get larger as the square of the number of turns. Core losses get smaller as the exponent to beta of the number of turns. That means as I change number of turns, one loss goes up, one loss goes down, they move at different rates, so there will be some optimal in there. Okay. So it's going to look something like this. The book uses delta B instead of the number of turns as their x-axis. This plot would look the same if I used n, but it would, instead of going from 0 up, it would go from a maximum down. Delta B inversely proportional to n in this relationship. But regardless of which way I plot it, there is a direction in which core loss increases and copper loss decreases. And if I plot the sum of those two, it means I'll have some valley somewhere. And if I can find this, this is where I minimize total losses. From there, the algebra gets quite messy. Going through, plugging in, expressions for function of the total current, what is the copper loss, here's the core loss, go through and make some approximation to core loss that's general across a lot of different ferrite type materials, rearrange this, what I get is, again, an equation, which on the left side are properties which only depend on the core. On the right side, either constants or design specifications or something about my intended circuit application. I can use this as my design method, similar to what we had for KG, where I had this centimeters to the fifth thing on one side and all of my circuit analysis on the other side. To eventually have what we call the KGFE method, where I have, again, some figure of merit, KGFE, depends on the core, as well as this exponent beta. In the book, this is approximated, leave beta about 2.7 to abstract away from it and solve KGFE for different core geometries independent of the material. And what we get out of this is, again, a closed form design method for now transformers. So calculate KGFE for the core, see if this inequality is satisfied. If it is, that means this core can work. can give you a specified total loss, which is really the only specification, that in turns ratio. If this is satisfied, go on and you can now back calculate N1, the portion of the window area and wire size for each of the windings, and then need to check whether or not it's saturated, because that's not an inherent part of the method. First inequality is not satisfied, need to try a bigger core. Okay. Last thing, how this plays out, just discussed at a high level. So as I go to higher switching frequency, over a reasonable range of switching frequencies, if I have a PWM converter, I've got a buck converter, got a defined duty cycle, a defined input voltage. So the volt seconds applied to the magnetic component are DVG times TS. So as I go higher in switching frequency, TS drops and I apply fewer volt seconds to my magnetic device. Okay. As I go up in switching frequency, then I should be able to push this optimization further, because I'm applying less volt seconds. That's going to result in less delta B. That's going to allow me to use a smaller core to get the same losses. My core losses should be smaller. Eventually, though, as I go to very high frequency, that effect is dominated by this FS to the alpha term, which causes the losses to get worse with frequency. And that takes over, and now I need a larger core to distribute that same amount of flux over a larger area and get flux density down. So this is just showing for some example design what the core size, this is pot core, it's using pot, which is a specific geometry of core, somewhat independent, but the total size and volume versus switching frequency and where this optimization puts the maximum flux density, or this delta B that's going to determine core loss. So over kind of this low frequency range, as I go up in switching frequency, my core is just getting smaller and I'm keeping about the same delta B. So I'm not dominated by this FS term yet. As I get up to very high frequency, my core starts getting bigger again and it starts pulling the delta B down, because those losses are now dominant. Because that FS to the alpha term has gotten so big that I need to operate with much lower flux density in order to keep my core losses from exploding. Okay. So higher switching frequency can reduce the size of magnetics for a given loss, but over some limited range, eventually things explode. And that is what I have to say about magnetics. Any questions on magnetics or anything else? So alpha, I don't have the slide. It was at the beginning of lecture last class, but alpha is the ratio of the window area used for each winding. So alpha sub I, there's an alpha defined for each winding. Alpha 1 would be how much of the total window area of the core is used for winding 1. So alpha 1 is 0.5. It means half of the window area is used for winding 1, half is used for winding 2. Talked a little bit about where that comes from in the actual design method. Alpha is going to fall out. You see at the top, there's no alpha left in anything. Comes down to this point before it's back in there. So by that point, you've already evaluated it, because every alpha should be divided according to the ratio of the apparent power of the winding over the total apparent power. So alpha I is equal to IRMS in winding I, the RMS in winding I divided by the sum over all windings of J. RMSJ, VRMSJ. Just the ratio of apparent power of each winding to the total apparent power. Yeah.
The double check, AG method, you are accounting for saturation, check for loss.
Correct. You are not going to get equivalent designs out of both. From that description, it might sound like, well, both of them fall out in the wash on the end, right? But it's where these things are pushing the design. So KG method is trying to minimize just copper loss subject to not saturating. It has no idea what the core loss is going to be. So it's going to push you as close to saturation as possible within the limited maximum flux density that you specify in order to get the winding resistance down. KGFE just tries to get the minimum sum of core and copper loss, no idea about saturation. They may spit out a design that is nowhere near saturation. It may spit out a design where your flux density is 10 times your saturation limit. It has no idea. It's just trying to minimize the sum of these two losses. It's very possible that you could run the KG and KGFE method on the same coupled inductor on a flyback transformer and get two different designs, both of which are valid. Run the KG method and you get something where core loss is not so bad. Run the KGFE method and get something that doesn't saturate. Both designs are valid but are very different. Generally, this one would likely be better because it minimizes the sum of loss mechanisms, and if it didn't saturate, it's going to be lower loss than the one where you didn't consider core loss. A question? Correct. There is an extension to this with gaps. Generally, it comes down to what do you expect the losses to be in your magnetic component. If you're putting a gap in there, it's more likely that this is something like a flyback where you want small ripple and a DC bias on your magnetizing inductance. And if you have small ripple, you have small delta B, and you may not care so much about core losses. It should be inherently small, designing this thing to be a filter, a small delta B. If it's a gapless inductor, a thing that's just supposed to be an ideal transformer, not supposed to be a filter inductance, coupled with the transformer, then you likely put no gap to make the magnetizing inductance as large as possible, but it's not affecting circuit operation. Then, because there's no gap, you're going to have a reluctance, which is very small, which is going to result in a lot of flux for the same bias. That means delta B is going to be big, and you need to consider core loss. So there is no definitive answer. Just if you have this, you design it this way. If you have this, you design it this way. It's kind of a bit of an art in terms of how hard are you pushing the design? What all do you think could be significant? You can always check. If you run the KG method, you're assuming core losses are small. You can always calculate them afterwards using the Symetz equation. Say, were they small? I run the KG method and specify that I want 1 watt of winding losses and solve my core losses, and they're 20 watts. I picked the wrong one. Maybe go try the other one. Same thing here. I find this thing saturated. I got to do something else. More generally speaking, both of these methods are really only applicable to kind of the not so advanced designs. I need something that's going to perform okay, going to work. I'm kind of in this tens of kilohertz range of switching frequency, and I'm okay if it's a little bigger than need be. Then these methods make it real easy to pump something out, get a design that'll work. I'm really trying to optimize, pushing the higher switching frequency and trying to make this thing as small as possible. much like overall converter design, magnetics design is going to come down to some sort of spreadsheet type design or MATLAB based iteration through, here's all of my design candidates, and I calculate the losses I think are significant in all of them and find the one that's the best for me. Magnetics design is quite difficult. It can be one of the hardest parts of converter design. That's why we spend a couple weeks on it here in the course. These methods useful when they work, but aren't going to cover all cases. Other questions?
Yeah. Kind of just more general question. So if you're designing like a transformer for something that line frequency near 60 hertz, you kind of have to. So you have to count. That's a super low frequency. I'm going to have a massive voltage thing. And when you have to design super high for this thing, my losses are going to be super big if this thing's at 1 megahertz. So I guess kind of my question, do you have different approaches if you know that your losses are going to be dominated by one end or the other?
Not really. I mean, in the end, you're trying to push regardless of the design specifications to a point where you're balancing the different loss mechanisms. And that point where you minimize total loss is going to be at a very different point in one design versus another, but still that's your goal, right? And you went through and did this KGFE method on a 60 hertz transformer versus a megahertz transformer. Okay, well, the 60 hertz, you try to use the same cores, it's going to immediately tell you that inequality is going to say, no, 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 none of these can satisfy it. You need something huge just to get enough area so that the flux doesn't kill you. You're going to end up, depending on the power level, a lot more windings to do the same thing. But you're still going to turn the crank and say, okay, this design has too few windings, results in no copper losses, but huge core losses. The other end of the spectrum on the high frequency does. So ideally none of them should have huge losses. If you tried to apply the design of one to the other, it certainly would, but once you turn the crank and design each one individually, you should be able to come up with a good design for each. There are practical things to consider, voltage level, what type of core materials make more sense here and there. You use laminated iron at line frequency, but nanocrystalline at high frequency. But all those fall out as coefficients on these equations, what are alpha, beta, and k in the core loss equation. So generally, you're going to end up with much smaller devices in the switch mode power supply than in just a line frequency magnetic. That's the subject of ongoing research. Is rather than using line frequency magnetics, can we have a bunch of AC to AC converters where I put switches at the 60 hertz, switch everything up to 100 kilohertz, send it through high frequency transformers, then reinvert back to low frequency AC. Been able to show in research that those can be smaller than a huge transmission scale transformer, but iron and copper are pretty reliable and don't fail a lot, whereas something that has to get to those power and voltage levels, many hundreds or thousands of semiconductor devices, is a little more of a reliability concern. Okay, that's the end of theory for the course. Just going to briefly talk about a few things that we didn't cover in the class, further topics in power electronics. One has to do with practical implementation, considering actual construction of these converters. Parasitics are extremely significant because, by its nature, any switch mode converter has pulsating currents and voltages. Here I'm showing just the normal buck converter. I look at these different current loops, I1 and I2. I2 is my filter inductor, that should be nice filtered constant. I1 is my pulsating input current, which looks like this, has these big, ideally di dt goes to infinity. When I consider a real circuit implementation of that, this physical loop made of wires connecting my input to my MOSFET and diode has inductances all throughout it. If I try to push an infinite di dt through that, I'm going to get huge voltage spikes. It's going to be a problem. So how to lay out these things? How can we decouple some of these parasitics through selective placement of capacitors at DC points to reduce the inductance seen by this pulsating current? This is a big component of practical implementation of power converters. That is a big focus in ECE 482, where we spend a lot of time building these things. Okay. Along that note, when we analyze these, we'd like to assume that all of our different waveforms are close to ideal square waves. When you look at an actual converter, you hopefully saw a little bit of this through the experiment. There's a whole lot more going on. Things don't look like ideal square waves. We've got limited ramp rates and overshoot and ringing due to parasitics and due to the actual behaviors of the switches, which are not just on-off. They are cutoff, saturation for a while, deep triode, coupled, perhaps turning on and off multiple times, got body diode conduction, LC ringing, reverse recovery, we talked about briefly. So how do we analyze this and look at the different switching losses? It's covered somewhat in ECE 581. We look at switching losses throughout the course. Okay. The component from the book we didn't cover, this is chapter 10 that we skipped. Looks at input filter design. So if I have my buck converter with this pulsating input current, I may need to put a filter on the input to prevent that pulsating input current from going back to my source and distorting it. If I don't consider this intelligently and put just a low frequency, low pass filter here, connect that up to my converter, I can actually have interactions between the filter and the converter that significantly alter its dynamics. This shows the controlled output transfer function, GVD, of the original converter in the dashed line. And this dark one is the filtered converter. Magnitude looks not so different. There's this little notch here, but phase suddenly had this 540 degree drop, which will almost certainly destabilize my system for whatever compensator I design. So input filter can have a big impact. What we do to prevent that is design these damped input filters. We saw a couple of things that looked like this on homework problems. We probably thought Dr. Kostinitz being a jerk and giving me some arbitrary filter design that would never be used for anything. But these actually are real designs where we've got the main filter would be a two low-pass filters in series. And then these extra elements are damping to prevent that resonance from causing undesired issues with our controller. Chapter 12 in the book covers current program mode control, which is kind of a fundamentally different way of controlling these things. And we will use this in ECE 482. A controller that is not modeled through transfer functions and averaging small signal type analysis that relies on instantaneous sensing and control action. The way it works is it senses the current through that top switch, the buck converter, compares it to some reference value, and instantaneously, whenever the current through the switch goes above that reference, switches the device. So it's no longer providing a duty cycle, it's no longer controlled to be fixed frequency and duty cycle controlled so that the current when that thing switches is exactly whatever I tell it to be. Okay. So the modeling of this, I will no longer have a duty cycle to output voltage transfer function because I don't control the duty cycle. I control the peak input current directly. Nice things about this, it simplifies the dynamics of the system and it inherently has some protection built in because I limit the current in my MOSFET. I don't have to worry about overcurrent events on it because I'm directly controlling it. This is a comparison between a GVD transfer function like we've solved and a control transfer function in a CPM converter. Much simpler dynamics, no resonant pole, just a nice two-pole response, slow roll-off, easier to compensate. Digital control, gaining popularity, looks a lot different than the analog control that we've been focused on in this course. We have to worry about things like A to D delay and quantization error, quantizing and limiting in the PWM, everything getting fit into a digital bin. What impacts does that have? The advantage, we can design this small, we can do more advanced things, like dynamically changing what the transfer function is with different operating conditions. Resonant and soft switching topologies covered in section 5 of the book at the end. These are converters for which the analysis techniques we developed in this class will not apply because waveforms in the center of it here are entirely AC. If I tried to run my waveform averaging, I'd get everything zero and this thing doesn't work. It works because it basically has full bridge inverter, full bridge rectifier, from DC to DC, inverts to large AC-only waveforms in the tank, designs passives here to get some desirable characteristics, and rectifies them out the back end. Similar, we have soft switching converters, which are not fully resonant, but contain intervals in them where they are resonant. Both resonant and soft switching converters have advantages in lowering switching losses, but more complex analysis. Okay, you just finished CCE 481 as far as lectures. One more small thing to do. Here's where you can go. In continued power electronics, 482 will be offered in the spring. Beyond that, at the graduate level, we have one of the established courses as well as four more related to the wide band gap traineeship. ECE 581 is perhaps the most direct follow-on to this one that'll cover theory and analysis of resonant and soft switching converters. Many of the other courses then get into specific applications, drives, utility applications, more on semiconductors, and so on. This is the password to access the final exam on the website. The GL is for good luck. Hope you remember it. We'll be available for questions as normal during the final exam time. I will likely not hold my normal office hours. I'll be available to schedule via email here on out. Office hours tomorrow. I'll hold my office hours tomorrow. Still a normal class day. So email me if you have questions. I will email this out with an SAIS reminder and with solutions to the last homework for class. Thank you guys for all your hard work this semester. Good luck on the final. Enjoy Christmas break.